This is the Marketing Podcast Network. You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
Welcome to Uncorking a Story, the podcast that introduces you to the rich world of storytellers who share their personal journeys, creative processes, and the stories behind their stories, one conversation at a time. I'm your host, Mike Carlin, and I'm thrilled to be part of your writing journey. If you're an aspiring writer, a literary enthusiast, or simply someone who believes in the transformative power of words, you've come to the right place. Every week, we'll pop the cork on the world of successful storytellers and give you a healthy pour of inspiration, insight, and empowerment. My mission is to help writers like you realize your full potential through the transformative and therapeutic power of writing. Whether you're just starting your literary voyage or looking to refine your craft, I'm here to provide you with the knowledge, inspiration, and encouragement you need to embark on your own storytelling adventure. So, are you ready to uncork your story and let your creativity flow? Uncorking a Story is about to begin. Sit back, relax, and let the transformative magic of storytelling whisk you away. Welcome to Uncorking a Story. Peter Malone Elliott is an author, screenwriter, and developmental editor who has earned a Leo Award nomination for Best Screenwriting Motion Picture. Born and raised in Virginia, he now lives in Brooklyn, but still holds the magic of the mountains and Southern living near and dear to his heart. He joins me today on Uncorking a Story to chat about his career and about his debut novel, Blue Ridge. Welcome to Uncorking a Story, Peter.
Thank you so much for having me, Mike. It's great to be here.
I'm happy to have you here, Peter. And I'm curious, where does your story as an author begin?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, I was a screenwriter by trade. I was living in LA for a long time until, like a lot of us in 2021 in the pandemic, I moved home and I was staying home for a while, which is back in Virginia. And I was taking, you know, I couldn't talk to anyone. I couldn't go out. I couldn't socialize, right? So I was taking these long, long hikes in the Blue Ridge Mountains. And, you know, I don't know if you've ever been to the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia, Mike, but they're beautiful. They're stunning, but they are a little spooky and a little mysterious and a little like, okay, there's an underbelly here. There's something spooky here. And, you know, I had always been in the back of my brain. I always knew that I wanted to take a crack at writing a novel at some point. My mother is a New York Times bestselling novelist. I kind of grew up with being an author in the blood, right? And something that had always fascinated me was the idea of identical twin brothers and the idea that you're always considered part of a unit or an entity as opposed to your own individual person. And that idea and how it could spool across like a psychological thriller context was fascinating. So I was thinking about this while I was looking at these mountains, like, okay, I think there's a marriage made in heaven here. And then I kind of just went from there. So I spent, you know, I spent a year writing the novel. I started at the beginning of 2021. I finished it at the beginning of 2022. And then, you know, I did the whole, you know, querying nonsense for a while. And then finally I ended up getting a publishing deal. So that's kind of the short and sweet version.
Oh, very cool. I do want to dig into your background a bit more as a screenwriter, because it seems like that's where it began. And I'm just curious if you could just, you know, to talk about that a little bit. And I'm always interested in the differences between, you know, writing for the screen and writing for the page.
Sure. Yeah. So something that is a challenge about screenwriting is that you're oftentimes limited by the nature of the medium, right? I mean, it's not, a lot of times it's not really meant to be a work of writing. It's meant to be a blueprint to go shoot something, right? And whereas in a novel, you can have an unlimited amount of time to describe something, a setting, for example. In a screenplay, you know, with an action description, you have a sentence, maybe two if you're really lucky, but that's the most. So something that my screenwriting background kind of drilled into me and it's really served me well for writing thriller novels, I think, is the importance of conciseness and brevity and pacing and propulsiveness, and not, and having every single scene mean something and lead to something and be a building block for something else. There's no, in any of my books, I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of wasted air because of that screenwriting background. You know, I mean, who knows? One day I might write 120,000 word epic, but I don't think so. But maybe, you never know. So it's been really fascinating juggling between those two worlds and kind of flexing different creative muscles, you know.
Did you find you had a hard time like transitioning from, you know, writing for the screen towards writing long form, or did it come more natural to you?
I wouldn't say it came natural, but it was a lot more freeing. I felt like, you know, to use a not amazing analogy, but it's the best I can think of off the top of my head, I felt like a dog that had kind of been let off a leash and I can kind of just free range around a farm, right? And track and chase after deer and whatnot. Something that also really appealed to me about writing a novel, which is something that you can't do in a screenplay unless you're Christopher Nolan, is write in the first person, right? And do a dueling first person POV, which is how Blue Ridge is told. And, you know, no matter how great a screenplay is, there are exceptions, obviously, but no matter how great a screenplay is, it can never get into the same depths of the psychological human condition the way a book can, because you can really, really go a lot deeper. And so, no, I don't think it was more challenging. It opened up a lot more possibilities, if anything.
Yeah. Well, I do want to dig into Blue Ridge a little bit more, because you mentioned, you know, this idea of biological twins or identical twins.
Yeah.
And I will point out that I am a twin. I have a twin brother.
Oh boy. Okay.
And there have been times where I have thought about ending his life, but I never really did. We are fraternal, sure. and I am the father of triplets.
Wow. Okay.
And none of them are identical either, but don't drink the water in my house.
Sure.
you know, I'm just curious at, like, how this story came to, because it is somewhat diabolical.
Yeah.
In this idea of, you know, brother killing brother or trying to kill brother.
Yeah. 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 So, I mean, like I mentioned the identical twin and the Cain and Abel dynamic that had always kind of fascinated me my entire creative life. I myself don't have an identical twin brother. I have an older sister, and Megan, if you're listening, I promise you I've never plotted to kill you at any point. So I should start off by saying that. In terms of like tonal touch points for me, besides what I just said, something that was a big jumping off point for me in terms of like kind of the brotherly bond amidst on the backdrop of like a gritty, bleak crime thriller or drama, right, was Hell or High Water. I don't know if you've seen that movie by Taylor Sheridan. It's Chris Pine and Ben Foster and Jeff Bridges. It's about bank robbing brothers in Texas, in West Texas. And that, seeing that, was really a big jumping off point. And then also that combined with the works of Sham Shepard, which also deals with a lot of familial strife and brothers kind of at each other's throats, and the simmering tension of familial secrets and what people will do to keep those secrets buried. And so all of that was kind of like a nice little gumbo for me to get going with, you know.
Got it. You know, you mentioned Cain and Abel. It is a story that is kind of, you know, as old as time, right?
Yeah.
Like brothers wanting to do harm to each other.
Yeah.
But not, certainly not without consequences.
No, of course. Yeah. And it, you know, without giving anything away, if you read the book, you'll see that both brothers have a certain price to pay. And, you know, I'll leave that to you to discover what I mean.
Yeah, fair enough. You know, given your background as a screenwriter, do you have an intention to translate this to something for the big screen?
Yeah, I've thought about it. I've thought about how I would do it and what the structure would be. So it's something now I do in my career. I do kind of plan the hop back and forth between novels and screenplays. At this point, though, I am more leaning into the novel aspect of things. I am really enjoying exploring that side of my creativity. But the short answer is yes. Yeah. And if someone wants to option the rights, I own the film and TV rights for the book. I have an idea how to do it. So you can pay me to write the script.
There you go. You're gonna, you can have your own adapted screenplay.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I'm curious, like going through the writing process, what are some of the big things you've learned about yourself, you know, as you were developing this and as you were kind of, you know, writing this novel?
That's an interesting question. Like, you mean from like a process standpoint or just about me as like a person and human being or both?
Yeah, more maybe both, but I'm always curious as to like insights who come into your that kind of come to you from your own life or about your own life as you're going through, you know, all the introspection that's required, even when you're writing fiction, you know, to put together like a full manuscript.
Sure. Something that I would say is probably always going to be a recurring theme in all of my work, and writing Blue Ridge and developing Blue Ridge really solidified this in my head, was familial trauma and secrets and dealing with that and having really, really dramatic heightened consequences as a result of that trauma. And, you know, without getting too deep in the weeds here, I'm able to channel a lot of stuff that I've dealt with on my own and dealt with in therapy and, you know, my own ruminating and whatnot, and put it on the page and kind of, you know, to use a cliche expression, but to exercise my demons out through my characters. And that's something that I find really interesting. And I don't know if I ever am going to have it in me to have a main character that's like completely happy and go lucky and just everything's fine. I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to do that. Maybe though, you never know. But that's probably the biggest thing that definitely solidified in my brain as I was doing Blue Ridge. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I hear it time and time again from authors and even in my own work, it's the writing can be a very therapeutic process.
100%.
You know, because you are kind of digging into like a portion of your soul and you're revealing it.
Yeah.
And that's something that requires a tremendous amount of vulnerability, even when you're writing fiction. You know, it's not, you know, I get it with memoir, right? It's pretty self-explanatory. Yeah. You're telling the story of your life, it's you. But even in fiction, there is that you are tipping your hat a little bit to something that's kind of going on inside yourself. I just kind of find that fascinating, and just opening yourself up to that process is important. And that's how, go ahead.
No, sorry. I was just going to add to that. Yeah. I mean, it's a running joke I have a lot of friends in the thriller and crime fiction community. Right. And the running joke amongst us is that people who write really, really disturbing things are often the most well-adjusted people. Like if you go to like Thriller Fest, for example, the people that you'll meet at Thriller Fest, they write really, really dark stuff a lot of the time. Right. But they are the most well-adjusted, friendly, normal people because they get it out all on the page. Right. And it's, they don't keep it pent up. They kind of vomit it out and they're like, all right, I'm done. Cool. You know?
And then like on the flip side of that are stand-up comics who, you know, whose job it is to make you laugh. Right. Yet they're like usually the most like screwed up people I've ever met in terms of demons.
Yeah. So, yeah. And I think in fiction, you don't need to go any further than like, you know, stuff like the King of Comedy or Joker to see how that can kind of manifest itself in a dramatic standpoint anyway. No. Yeah. Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. You know, you kind of mentioned it before going through the querying process and getting a publishing deal.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the people who listen to this show are aspiring authors themselves and they always, you know, want to know, like, how can they do it? So what advice do you have for, you know, someone who's up and coming or aspiring to get a manuscript from, you know, that sort of manuscript, you know, stage to on the shelf at their local bookstore?
Sure. Yeah. So I have an answer for this, somewhat long answer. So bear with me here while I kind of ramble a little bit. So in this day and age, we are in kind of a golden time in publishing because yes, there's gatekeeperdom and yes, there's inequality and, you know, yes, that's all still exists and still there. But in terms of the access that you have to these really cool independent presses and small presses and people that take unagented submissions are vast and unlike any other time we've ever had in the industry. So, you know, I mean, for example, for me, for my journey for Blue Ridge, once I finished it and, you know, I edited it and I got it read by my beta readers and blah, 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 did all that and it was ready to send out. You know, I sent it to probably, I was going to like, all right, I'm going to get an agent. I'm going to do the traditional big five thing. You know, here we go. Great. I sent the manuscript out to about 100 agents. I got, I want to say 10 to 12 full manuscript requests and a lot of nice words and nice compliments. And, you know, the writing's great, not right for us, blah, 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 whatever, fine. It was discouraging. And this went on for 8-9 months probably. And I was about ready to put it in the drawer and just like, all right, I got my first novel out. I'll move on to the next one. And, you know, thinking about what I just said in terms of all these really great independent presses that are traditional presses and, you know, pay royalties and all that stuff and, you know, pay advances that take unsolicited submissions from unagented authors. Like, all right, you know what? Before I completely put this away, let me just try this. Let me see what happens. So I sent it out again to, about a dozen or so of these presses, and I got two offers within 2 weeks. And so, you know, and I got really lucky and I got to be able to choose between two great presses, and I ended up putting it out with Level Best Books, who's very well heralded in the crime fiction community. So answering your question, the advice I would give is there's going to be people who tell you that you have to publish in a certain way, that you have to do it one prescribed way. And I can just tell you uncategorically that that's false and just not the case. There are so many outlets, so many avenues. There's small presses, there's indie presses, there's mid-side houses, there's hybrid publishing, there's self-publishing. You know, there is so much you can do to get your work out there. You have to have the perseverance and the thick skin in order to get it done, but it is out there. And look at things not necessarily from, you know, the straight on vantage point. Don't be afraid to come out of left field a little bit would be my advice.
Yeah, I think that's great advice, because it is so easy to get discouraged when you are querying 100 agents and you're getting back a lot of, and most of the time there's not a lot of feedback with the form letter. You know, it's usually, you know, thanks, but, you know, this isn't right for us. And you're lucky if you get, you know, someone who says something about the quality of your writing.
Sure.
But even that's sometimes enough to keep going a little bit if they provide some kind of constructive feedback, but you are right. There are other publishing vehicles or avenues out there that really weren't available, you know, 20 years ago.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, in terms of just querying an agent, I know there's, you know, if you ask 12 people in the publishing industry, you'll get 12 different answers. So, you know, this is no different. But if you're querying agents for, you know, the traditional big five route, don't be afraid to query to a decent amount of people. Like I've read advice online that says you should only query like 20 people and then stop. That's not true. You shouldn't query 500 or 300. That's too much. But like things take so long nowadays, and agents are so in over extended with their work levels and reading lists. You know, if you only query 20 people, you might not hear back from any of them, and you just might feel like you're kind of swimming in a fishbowl alone. So don't be afraid to widen your net a little bit.
I think, yeah, very good advice. Very good advice. I have to ask, given your screenwriting background, did you watch the Oscars last night?
I didn't. I was putting together IKEA furniture with my girlfriend, which in hindsight was probably a bad decision. But I have seen clips and I saw the results, so I'm informed. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to ask a more interesting question then. Are you and your girlfriend still together after putting together the IKEA furniture?
We are, and she's moving in. So, you know, I think if we can get past that, I think we're good, but we'll see.
You know, I think that is, you know, there's before I got married, I had to go through something called an engaged encounter workshop.
Okay.
Which is something that, I guess the church wanted us to do. Right. So we had to go for a weekend and, they have you go through all sorts of like scenarios, like what would you do if you argued about money? And you know, something about sex, something about wanting to have children. I think the true test of a relationship would be to put two people in a room with a bedroom set from IKEA and ask them to put it together. And, you know, you just get the Allen wrench and the pictures of the faceless people, you know, that, that come in there. And if you can come out of that experience still together
and
with a bedroom actually put together, then I think you're good. I think that'll that's a better predictor of relationship stability than anything else.
Okay. All right. Well, hey, I'll quote you on that in 5 years and see if we're still together.
Well, I think I'm gonna send that to the church, and that'll be my advice.
Right. Yeah.
one thing I always like to do is get to know my guests a little bit more through some pop culture questions. Right. And I'm curious, Peter, when you were growing up, what were some of your favorite shows to watch on TV as a kid?
Ooh. Okay. How are we defining kid? Like kid or young adult?
Kid.
Okay. Ooh. You know, honestly, I didn't really get into TV until I was a young adult. And then, you know, because I was kind of coming of age, quote unquote, in the golden age of TV when like Mad Men was in its pomp and Breaking Bad and True Detective and all these things. So that's kind of when I really got into prestige TV. Before that, my family did a really good thing of giving me a really good film education in terms of like, you know, old movies and 80s and 90s thrillers and whatnot. And, you know, more recent things too.
Movies. Forget TV. Tell me some of those movies that they exposed you to.
I was probably in hindsight a little too young to be watching this, but I was 12 or 13 when I saw The Departed with the Scorsese movie. And that just blew my head open in terms of, oh my God, you can do this and they'll pay you to do this. This is what? And just the fact that they could explore such, it's not a perfect movie, obviously, but like the fact that they could explore such deep themes in such a pulpy and gritty context is really fascinating me. And then from there I discovered things like, you know, like Pulp Fiction and Seven and Good Will Hunting and, you know, a lot of that stuff. So I was really a big 90s and early aughts movie junkie. That was kind of like my childhood, more or less. Yeah.
I saw Pulp Fiction with my father, and at the time she was my girlfriend.
Yeah.
And we took my friend Zach. So Zach and I were eating up every frame of that film.
Yeah.
We loved it so much.
Yeah.
My girlfriend, who is now my wife, and my father were ready to walk out of the movie theater. Like that was, they just could not understand it. They thought it was obscene, which of course parts of that movie are extremely obscene.
Very obscene. Yeah.
But just the storytelling and just the characters and just the total vibe of that film. Yeah. I loved it. I watch it at least once a year.
Yeah.
I just love that movie so much.
And it's really one of those things that, you know, I mean, there's a lot of times where you watch movies that you loved when you were growing up and it's like, oh, this doesn't really hold up. Yikes. And Pulp Fiction for the most part really, really does. And it really is kind of a stroke of genius in terms of structure and dialogue and character development and pacing and all that stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah. How about music? What are some things you like listening to?
Well, I listened to a lot of jazz because I played saxophone for 8 or 9 years. So it was a lot of jazz growing up in the house. I loved, this is kind of completely the other direction, but I loved Kid Cudi. I loved Kid Cudi. His first two albums were very, very powerful for me in an emotional place in my life and very helpful in terms of getting me through some tough times. And then, you know, like my mom has this amazing vinyl record collection, which I'm trying to replicate now, but, you know, I don't think I'm ever going to. So like, you know, I would stumble across these gems of like these, you know, big band artists from the 40s and 50s that just knocked my socks off. And, I love, admittedly, this is a cliche answer. I love Frank Sinatra. I really, really do. And I went through a phase where I was basically listening to Frank Sinatra nonstop. So I still love him. I've kind of graduated from that phase now, though. But
yeah, I usually cook on Sundays in my house, and if I'm cooking, it's usually an Italian meal because I'm half Italian by genetics, but all Italian by sort of cultural identity. And I always have on Frank Sinatra radio when I cook, because just that music is just, I don't know, I think it makes the food taste better. But he was featured pretty prominently in this documentary I just watched about Quincy Jones. I think it's called Quincy.
Yeah. I've heard that's really good. I haven't seen it yet, but yeah, I've heard it's great.
Yeah, it was fantastic, and great stories about Frank Sinatra.
Yeah,
and actually, my brother has a friend from college who is like the Frank Sinatra impersonator in Vegas right now.
Wow,
Like, I mean, he was a great singer, like vocalist himself, and then he winds up in Vegas, and he had surgery, and now he looks like a young Frank Sinatra. It's kind of scary, actually.
Wow. But, so like what era does he impersonate of Sinatra? Is it like older one? Is it like Pomp, Capitol Records, Frank Sinatra? Or is it kind of just a mix of everything?
Kind of Capitol Records, Frank Sinatra. Yeah. I would say the Capitol year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was him. No one could touch him in that stretch. That was his prime, in my opinion. Yeah.
And I guess last up is if you could go write a letter to your younger self, mail it to the younger Peter, what kind of advice would you give your younger self?
Wow. That's a great question. I would probably tell my younger self to not be so hard on myself and to laugh more and not be quite as high strung as I was, and give him a hug and tell him that's going to be okay and that things are going to work out. You just, you have a good head on your shoulders. You're on the right path. Just, for lack of a better expression, believe in the process. That's probably what I would say. Yeah.
So many of us worry so much when we're younger.
Yeah.
You know, I see it in my kids now. So I have my triplets are about to turn 22, and I've got one who's always so worried. She's like, I think I failed this exam. You know, my life is over. Yeah. And first of all, she never fails anything. She gets A's on everything.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why are you so worried? Like, it's even if you did fail it, it's one exam.
Yeah,
it's one thing, and then you'll do better on the next one. I'm like, but I remember being like that too. Like, I was always worried about something, and it always turns out the way it's supposed to turn out, right? There are just some things we have a little limited control over. So I love that advice to not worry so much.
Yeah.
Well, Peter, tell us, where can people pick up Blue Ridge?
Yeah, so you can get it pretty much wherever you get books. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Apple Books, Bookshop. You know, if you Google it, you'll find it. It's not hard to find. and then, if you want to follow me on, I hate saying this, but if you want to follow me on social media, I'm on Instagram at PME Writer, and you can go on my website, which is pmelliott.com, and you can see what I've got going on there. I got some events going on. I'm on tour for the next 3 or 4 months. So I had a smattering of stuff going on virtual and in person. So
very cool. Well, I'll have, I'll put your link to your website, link to your Instagram, and then a link to where people can buy your books in our show notes. So people can just go to the show notes and look all that stuff up. And Peter, I'll say thank you for stopping by Uncorking a Story and letting me uncork yours.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike. Thank you for uncorking my brain. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Uncorking a Story. If you'd like more information about today's guest or to find out more about Mike, go to uncorkingastory.com. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review us at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Tune in every week to hear Mike Carlin uncork a new story.